become a member of the Movie Geeks United family. Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, Facebook at facebook.com/moviegeeksunited. Subscribe to us through iTunes. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/moviegeeksunited. You can also access our entire archive of content, including over 700 filmmaker interviews, at blogtalkradio.com/moviegeeksunited or at our official website at moviegeeksunited.net. Thank you for joining us for the Movie Geeks United 25th anniversary celebration of Clean and Sober. Released on August 10th, 1988, Clean and Sober features the first major dramatic performance from Michael Keaton, who was previously known for his comedic roles. This story of a hustling drug addict who checks himself into a rehab to escape trouble with the law was directed by Glenn Gordon Caron. Mr. Caron had established an outstanding career as the creator of the hit TV series Moonlighting. Seizing upon a worthy challenge in the film realm, Mr. Caron took Clean and Sober under his wing and assembled a terrific supporting cast, including Kathy Baker, Morgan Freeman, and M. Emmett Walsh.
That was a $90,000 phone call, man. $90,000. $90,000, man! That's the stock market, babe! And it doesn't give a fuck if I'm in a hospital or not! Hey, the American Stock Exchange really doesn't care if some asshole makes $300 a week since I can't use the fucking phone! Of course, right, Craig? Like 310, maybe 315? Right? That's about it, right? Isn't it, Craigie? Yeah, oh boy, big 307 a week. Boy, you gotta allocate that motherfucker, don't you? What's that, lean cuisine? Maybe some pork and beans? Hey, why don't you get yourself another pair of those plastic shoes? Fine! You want me out of here? I'm fucking out of here! I'm gone! Motherfucker, look at his back!
Did Clean and Sober come as Moonlighting was kind of coming to a close?
I want to say I was in the midst of doing Moonlighting, and I had always wanted to be a film director. I'd never imagined that I'd have a career in television. It just sort of wasn't on my radar. I didn't watch television. And then suddenly I was, you know, I'd created Moonlighting, and it sort of blew up, and it was this huge thing, and I was incredibly grateful for it. And in the midst of that, I started to get offers to contemplate directing movies, but they were all kind of raucous comedies. I suppose people looked at Moonlighting and thought, "Oh, he can, you know, he can make funny movies." And I wasn't much interested in doing what I was doing anyway. You know, I was doing that with Moonlighting, and I was doing it without any interference at all. So it didn't make sense to me to go jump on a movie where I would be a little out of my depth and all that. And then somewhere along the line, there was an executive at Warner Brothers named Bruce Berman, and he sent me the script for Clean and Sober, which was written by Todd Carroll. And he said, "We really like this, although we recognize there are problems with it," meaning the script. "If you could rewrite it in such a way that it would entice us to make the film, we would consider letting you direct." And that was really how I got involved. I did a fairly comprehensive rewrite, and the studio got excited and said, "Oh boy, let's go make a movie."
So, when you read the script, Mr. Carroll's version of the script, what was it about it specifically that spoke to you, and what work needed to be done on it?
I suppose the thing that spoke to me was I absolutely understood. I understood that sort of self-destruction. My dad was a really hardcore alcoholic who never went in AA or anything like that. He died, I think, surrounded by like 70 bottles of rum. I mean, he was just hardcore. So I understood the pathology, and I think saw some aspects of it in myself, and just thought, I get this guy. I know who this guy is, and I was sort of fascinated by it. At the same time, from a purely sort of pragmatic show business point of view, I thought, well, this is about as different from Moonlighting as it's going to get, and I really wanted to the directors that I admired you know, were people who didn't make the same film over and over. They were people like John Huston, who made a variety of different films and different mm-hmm. types of films, and Arthur Penn, and you know, Mike Nichols, who was a little more of a stylist. But I very much wanted to, at that moment in my life, say, you can't define me just by moonlighting.
Right.
So I was very, very intrigued by that. And the thing that was going on in the script that I think, for me, the place where it needed the most sort of attention was, and I wasn't privy to everything that had happened prior to my arrival, so Todd may have been directed to do some of the things that he did by other people, but it was really trying to sort of have its cake and eat it, too. It was trying to be a movie about a guy coping with substance abuse, and at the same time, like when he went into rehab, it was sort of a raucous Animal House, kind of crazy, and I thought, I don't think you can occupy these two worlds together. I think you sort of have to commit to this guy and going on this journey with him, and that I felt I understood very strongly.
Did you scout various treatment programs to get a feel for what that experience is like?
Yeah, we went to some meetings and we went to some treatment programs. And in fact, I always remember going, we were somewhere in Pennsylvania, and I took Michael and Kathy in. Kathy Baker, who played Charlie in the film, she was not well known at the time, but Michael was, you know, a pretty big star. He had done Mr. Mom, and he had done Night Shift and stuff. So he put on a baseball hat and some glasses, and we went in and we went into a group therapy session, and it was pretty, you know, modest neighborhood, pretty low-income neighborhood, actually. And we were sitting there, and at one point this woman was pouring, a young woman is pouring her heart out, and she's in the midst of this thing, and she looks up and she goes, "Hey, are you Mr. Mom?" and Mike looked at her, and he went, nah. Yeah. And you could see on his face that, I'm going to tell her no, and then he realized, oh, this is a place you're really not supposed to lie at all.
Yeah.
And then all hell broke loose. Because the last thing they were expecting was a movie star in the middle of this really, 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 really low-rent, bare-bones recovery facility. But yeah, we did. We went to meetings, and we went to some, as I say, recovery facilities. And I know my instinct was always the same. Whenever a meeting was over, I think, God, I just really want to get a drink. It's very dark and very depressing. Having said that, we sort of had a ball making the movie, which I know makes no sense, but I think when you traffic and stuff that's that dark, there is something, you know, about trying to keep it as light as you can, which we did.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I've always really liked about the movie and appreciated about it is that it's not one epiphany that changes his life. I mean, it really portrays it as an ongoing process, you know,
yes,
that will remain throughout his life to kind of keep his head above water. And also the fact that the character, and this is so true of addicts, from whatever limited experience I've had with it, but his first instinct is to always evade, avoid and evade.
Yeah, there's that, and then, you know, it's interesting, too. I watched the movie again sort of in preparation for this conversation, and I had forgotten, too, how he so sort of nimbly swaps obsessions. You know, he's obsessed with drugs, and then he becomes obsessed with this woman that he frankly didn't have much time for when he first met her. And it's very interesting how the transference works. And the movie is very, one of the things I'm very proud of is the fact that it is quite, his transformation is very slow, and in that sense, to me, very real. Because, as you say, there is no single epiphany. There isn't that one moment.
And the casting of Michael Keaton, I mean, he was in a position similar to yours. I mean, you both were known primarily for comedic work. So it must have felt like a risk to go with him as well, at least from a studio standpoint.
Well, the studio really had an issue. I did a draft, maybe two of the script, handed it in. The studio got very excited and immediately wanted Jack Nicholson to play the part. And Jack Nicholson was probably the biggest movie star in the world at that point. And I was an enormous Jack Nicholson fan. Five Easy Pieces for me was like a seminal movie when I was like 16 years old, 15 years old. I was just like, oh my God. Having said that, I felt he was ridiculously wrong for this movie. I said, I think he's too old. I think he's beyond the age at which we believe he's salvageable. And, you know, we really need a younger guy, somebody in their 30s, blah, 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 all that kind of stuff. And I said I really wanted Michael. Michael was coming off a string of, I want to say, three or four box office failures in a row. I can't remember all the names, but The Squeeze was one. And
Right.
Johnny Dangerously had disappointed. There was just a bunch of them. And the feeling was that maybe he was no longer a movie star. By the way, I need to also tell you that Tony Gans and Debbie Blum, who were the producers on the movie and worked for Ron Howard, had always imagined this as a Michael Keaton movie. So I heard that when I first got the script, and I think it was always in my head, and I really tried to write it into Michael's mouth. And I was really devastated when the studio seemed to have absolutely no appetite for him. Nonetheless, we went to Michael and said, hey, we'd really like you to do this movie. And his manager at the time said, absolutely not. He hasn't done his Ghostbusters yet. He needs to do his huge, big comedy score. You know, I'm not going to let him play some coke addict. And he seemed very definitive about that. I mean, that door was firmly closed. And at the same time, I was getting calls asking me if I would meet with Tom Hanks. And Tom had just done a movie called Nothing in Common with Jackie Gleason. And like Michael, was coming off a string of movies that were not as successful as his earlier movies and was sort of in a tentative place. But there was the feeling that with Nothing in Common, A, he had shown a lot of range, and B, he was probably back. So he and I met and talked. And I love Tom Hanks, who now you look back at the body of work and you go, well, this is probably, you know, the greatest American actor we have right now. You know, I mean,
absolutely.
My God. But at the time, I remember always having this sense of, this guy's really great, but he's not who I want. I want Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton has the sense of self-destructiveness, or I sensed it in him, in a way that I didn't in Tom. There's something inherently optimistic about Tom, at least at that moment, something sort of life-affirming. So long story short, I spent, I don't know, 2 or 3 months with the idea that Tom would be in the movie, and then I literally had an epiphany one day. It was actually Christmas. I thought, God damn it, the wrong guy is going to be in this movie. And then, and tell me when I'm talking too much, because I'll happily...
No, I mean, I've lived with this movie for so long, so this is such a joy to be able to hear the story behind it.
So here's the story behind it. So I go into work one day, and Bruce Willis read the script. And Bruce comes to me and says, I love this. Can I do this with you? And I said, oh, God, don't tell anyone that. They'll make me do it with you, and I don't want to. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, I do. I work with you every day. I need to prove that I can do something else. And he said, well, who do you want? And I said, well, I really want Michael Keaton. And apparently he went out that night or the night after, and he was in a bar, and Michael was there. And he walked up to Michael, and he said something like, and, you know, this is a few years ago, so you'll forgive me if this isn't a perfect summation, but he basically said, I don't know, are you allowed to curse on your podcast? Or?
Please, go ahead.
Okay. He said, you know, you're a fucking idiot. And he said, Michael said, why? Why am I a fucking idiot? He said, my friend wrote this movie for you, and it's brilliant, and you're not doing it. And Michael said, whoa, wait a second. He said, your friend is doing that movie with somebody else. And apparently Michael had not been told that his manager put his foot down. He'd been told, no, they went to somebody else. So Bruce came back to me, and that gave me an opportunity to call Michael and say, hey, can we have a meal? so we did, and I showed him the latest draft of the script and said, you know, I would love you to do this. And he said, I would love to do that. He read it, agreed to do it. I had a long and, for me, a really painful conversation with Tom and said, you know what, I really want to go this other way. He was so amazing. I mean, just to let you know that the humanity that you sense in Tom Hanks's performance exists in his life as well. He said to me, wow, he said, you should have who you want. He said, can I be in your next movie?
Wow.
I said, I just want to be you when I grow up. You're so well adjusted.
Yeah, he's amazing.
It all worked out because he wasn't doing Clean and Sober, he had a hole in his schedule and he was free to do Big.
Hmm.
Which he originally wasn't going to do. Robert De Niro was going to star in Big. I mean, it's just how weird all these things happen.
And in retrospect, it all happens the way it was meant to all
exactly.
along.
Exactly. Yeah. And I must say, Michael, and I've had this happen to me a few times, Michael's one of those people who we met and we instantly clicked. We understood each other. We're still friends to this day. I just saw him, I guess, about 3 months ago. And I adore his performance.
Me too.
I'm very proud of it. Because he said to me, he said, you know, I've never done this before. I'm not sure I know how to do this. And then he said, you know, and then he turned around, there's Morgan Freeman. I mean, admittedly before he was Morgan Freeman. But, you know, still a formidable person. There's Kathy Baker. You know, it was, you know, he was playing in the bigs. And he was great.
He's remarkable in that movie. That's one of the great performances of that decade for me, absolutely. But there's something about Daryl Pointer, too, that... I mean, he's a very difficult character because he's not extremely likable, and it can't be performed in a way that ingratiates itself to an audience at all.
That's true.
It takes a really brave performer to do that, I think.
I kept saying to him, listen, this may open on an airplane, you know. I don't know. I can't believe they're letting us make this. And he said, I don't care. Let's just do it, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, the cast is so excellent from top to bottom. You mentioned Morgan Freeman and Kathy Baker, but the cast member that really fascinates me because it's such an unexpected pairing with Michael Keaton is Emmett Walsh. And we spoke with him a couple of years ago, actually, and talked a little bit about Clean and Sober.
Oh.
I think he's extraordinary and completely unexpected in the movie.
I don't know. He popped in my head. I think I had seen him in Blood Simple. And he just stayed with me, and I thought, I'd really love to have him in the movie. And he was available. We did the movie, and then he did my second movie. And for a while, I thought, well, he'll always be my touchstone. I'll put him in every movie.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the second movie was an enormous failure. So you go, maybe he's not my touchstone. But I love M. Emmett Walsh, and weirdly, I had a meeting over at Sony 2 weeks ago, and literally as I was driving through the gate, I saw him walking the other way, and I almost leaned over and screamed, Emmett, but it physically wasn't, you know, the right thing to do. I don't think I've seen him in probably, you know, 15 years, but God, I love him. He's just an amazing presence.
Oh, he's one of the great character actors, absolutely, and he has very fond memories of working on Clean and Sober.
Oh, that's cool.
Incidentally, the next movie you did, we'll get right back to Clean and Sober, of course, but the next movie you did, Wilder Napalm, I have vivid recollections of because you shot it in my hometown.
Oh, where did you live?
Lakeland, Florida.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I always remember that there was a big movie shooting in my little town, and that was very exciting. And the other thing that strikes me about the film is the look you crafted for it, because there's not so much a color palette as a lack of color palette. I mean, it's very gray.
Well, I said to Jan Keyser, who is the cinematographer, I really wanted it to look like a hangover. I wanted it to look like a bruise. And the more we talked about that, I realized there's a certain lack of, you know, when one has overindulged, there's a certain lack of definition. There's this sense when your head is throbbing and all that kind of thing of, a lack of color, and I suppose. And I had seen a couple of films that I thought got pretty close. In fact, the first cameraman that I interviewed for the job was Jordan Cronenworth, who, of course, had done Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. But he had done a movie called Cutter and Bone that I thought got close to the sort of look I was trying to get. And he was an amazing man, Jordan Cronenworth. He was quite ill when I met with him, and had been for quite a while. But the mere fact that he had photographed Blade Runner made him sort of a god to me. And we had this hour-long meeting, and I was explaining all these images in my head and these textures and all that stuff, and it was all over. I said, so will you do this movie with me? And he said, no. And I was like, oh. And I can't remember who introduced Jan and I, but Jan had actually been an operator for Jordan Cronenworth. Hmm. And had shot and been an operator, I want to say, for a number of really, really sort of top-drawer cinematographers, and was starting to go out on his own. And he was a terrific collaborator for me. He really understood what it was I was going for. Additionally, if you look at how the film is composed, it begins extremely tightly. You know, Daryl's a very self-possessed guy, so I really wanted to sort of, everything is very sort of compressed, and we're tight on his face, and I want to say we use long lenses and all that kind of thing. And then as the movie progresses and as his world starts to open up, we use much more wide shots and shorter lenses and things like that. So the palette and look was very, very deliberate. As I said, I just looked at the movie again, and it held up pretty well, actually. I thought, hey, you know, okay.
No, it's a beautiful movie, both in terms of content and style. I've always felt so. But I read an interview with you from years ago, I think upon the first release of the film, and you started with a much longer cut of it, I believe.
Yes.
So there was a lot of footage that didn't end up in the final edit?
Well, the big thing, there were two or three things. Yeah, I think the first cut that I screened for people might have been 2 hours and 35 minutes. I mean, it was, you know, some of it was inexperience, and some of it was naivete, and some of it was just, I don't know, I suppose maybe a little arrogance. But there was a whole section of the film that was about Daryl getting his roommate Donald, who's a young kid, together with this girl who was on a different floor, and they sneak down to her room, and Michael Keaton ends up with this 14-year-old girl, and who says basically, do you want to sleep with me? You can sleep with me. Hmm. And he's so appalled at her lack of self-worth that it sort of rocks him a little bit. And it was a great sequence. Michael was great in it. The girl was fantastic. She was Viva's daughter from the Andy Warhol thing. Boy, I should remember her name. She's a wonderful actress, and I can't remember her name off the top of my head. But it was a great, I want to say it was about a 12-minute sequence.
Wow.
And Bob Daly, who was the head of Warner Brothers, said to me, that has to come out. And I said, why? I truly was, like, stupid about these things. I thought, you know, why? The movie's so dark, you know. Who? But, no, they, you know, so it came out. And the only other thing I remember them sort of really leaning on me about was there's a moment very early in the film where Michael throws up. He's in detox and he throws up.
Right.
For some reason, they found that incredibly disturbing. And said that has to come out. It seems so strange now because everybody throws up in every movie now. But back then, that was, for some reason, a big, big no-no. And other than that, I want to say most of it's there.
Now, does that footage exist anywhere that you know of?
That's a great question. I have no idea. I'm still angry that you can't get a DVD of it in its original aspect ratio. It's only in what they call full screen, which is not a full screen. You know, someday, I suppose Warners will get around to addressing that. And it seems like eventually they kind of get to every movie and put it in whatever the latest format is. But at the moment, I don't know. I should mention the editor on the movie, because we had a fantastic editor. His name is Richard Chu. Richard famously edited The Conversation. He edited Star Wars. He edited all these amazing films. But the movie that drew me to him was Risky Business, which I just thought was the most elegant and eloquently cut teen sex comedy I'd ever seen.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it was just like glass, that thing. And, I met him and just fell instantly in love, you know, and just thought, wow, this is the guy I want to, you know, work with for the rest of my life. And then as it happened, we, you know, because we really enjoyed each other's company, we couldn't because schedules and things like that. But he was just a fantastic editor.
Yeah. When it came out, the reception to it, also this was around the time, I think there were other movies that came out around this time that dealt with alcoholism and recovery.
There were a couple, yeah.
Yeah, and that seems to be the way it goes. I mean, there's unexpected kind of trends in filmmaking sometimes occur.
Yeah, well, I remember being asked about it, you know, saying, oh, so this is one of those, and I said, well, I have to be honest with you. It's not like somebody takes you in a room and says, okay, we're going to do all these drug movies, and you're doing one of them. You know, you really don't – you're not aware of it when you're doing movies back then, before the Internet and all that kind of stuff. I was not at all aware. And frankly, I didn't feel the movies were terribly similar. The two that come to mind, there was a James Woods movie called The Boost, James Woods and Sean Young.
And Bright Lights, Big City.
And Bright Lights, Big City, which some friends of mine were actually producing. But I felt like that was a very sort of upscale, glossy – almost sensational movie, and ours was much more sort of, you know, almost British kitchen sink kind of movie, you know, much more, to my mind, much more realistic.
I think so, too. But it does go to show that the whole notion of addiction and treatment, it was really hitting the mainstream.
Well, it was without a doubt. There was suddenly this realization that, oh, wait a second, drugs are ubiquitous. And a minute ago, they weren't. They were there, but they were sort of in the shadows or in the fringes or in the margins of society, but now they're everywhere.
Yeah.
So that was – and I remember being asked that question, too. So I remember when the film came out, someone said to me, so when I go to the video store and I go to the drug section, and I said, well, it won't be in the drug section. And they say, oh, yeah, no, it's a drug movie. And I said, it's not a drug movie. It's a man, it's about a man, and about, you know, and I had all this – stuff. And he said, Glenn, it's a drug movie. Because I really truly believed it was about all these other things. You know, it was about salvation, and on some level it was sort of this, you know, it was a romance, if you will, I suppose. And I just had all these other thoughts about it. And the fact that it was about drugs seemed not superfluous, but beside the point, that there's always some social malady. But of course, when it gets out there, it's a drug movie.
which is unfortunate, because I understand completely what you're saying. It really is about a man forced to reassess his life. And drugs just happens to be, you know, part of that journey.
Yeah, I always thought it would be on a shelf with, like, I always hoped it would be on a shelf with movies like The Hustler, you know?
Yeah.
You know, about men trying to figure out their way. It didn't occur to me that it would be on a shelf with, you know, drug movies. This is good for you to watch, or something. But so it goes.
When you reviewed it again recently, I mean, it's been 25 years, which I can't believe it's been 25 years since Clean and Sober came out, but did it take you right back to that point in time when you were making it, and were you pleased with what you saw?
I was pleased, more pleased than I would have expected to be. It didn't take me back to the time of making it. This is going to sound peculiar and maybe self-aggrandizing, and I apologize ahead of time. I actually found myself watching the movie. I was transported to some to a far greater extent than I would have expected. Every so often, I'd be reminded. I'll tell you the thing that struck me, and it has a very, 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 very strong sense of place.
Yes.
And yet, it was made, with the exception of 2 weeks' work, it was made completely on a soundstage. And
wow,
that was the thing I was really proud of, because we had always planned on making the movie on location, and then once I got the studio to commit to Michael, Michael couldn't leave. Michael was going through a bunch of personal things that made it impossible for him to leave town. And he said, if you can't live with that, then I should drop out. And I really wanted him. So I sat with the production designer, a guy named Joel Schiller, and I had a very, very specific history for each of the buildings and for every sort of place that he went into. And we were able, to a far greater extent than you would imagine, to actually create this strong sense of place, but do it all in Hollywood, California. And I was pretty proud of that.
Yeah, that is amazing, because that's absolutely a question that I had about where you shot. So I'm glad you brought that up, because it does feel so incredibly lived in. And the fact that that was shot on sound stages is is remarkable.
Well, what we did was I said, you know, every place that we encounter, like Daryl, should be a place that was built for another purpose and then repurposed. So the rehab center was actually an old elementary school.
Hmm.
Now, there was no elementary school. We built it. But I said to him, build it like an elementary school from the 30s and then, you know, retrofit. You know, if you need an electric outlet, I want to see visible conduit. If you know, all the urinals need to be 18 inches off the floor because they're for little kids. The water fountains need to be really low. It's all that institutional green paint, blah, blah. So they actually set about building a set for a 1930s school that was then retrofitted to be a 1980s. You know, everything was sort of approached that way and kind of come at that way. And I want to say the only real locations we shot were Charlie's house, Charlie's apartment, that house, that red brick house, which was really in a really rundown section of Pennsylvania. I can't remember the exact name of the place. The diner where he meets M. Emmett. And a couple of things, the bank M. Emmett works in. But by and large, the picture was shot on stages.
Wow. Do you think that Daryl Pointer turns out okay?
I think Daryl Pointer grows, and I think that's all you can ask. Whether his ultimate disposition is healthy or not, I don't think the movie is in any position to suggest, but I think he ends the movie a better person than he begins it. He feels, which is something he doesn't do early on. You know, the dead girl is lying in his bed, and he really needs a cigarette. That's kind of his reaction to that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you get to the end of the movie, and he mourns Charlie, you know, with M. Emmett Walsh and the Christmas lights and the snowball in the back and all that stuff. And Emmett says, basically, you're being selfish and self-involved again, and, you know, now let's get on with the business of life. And I think he comes out better than he went in. Is he well? I think that's strong, and I would tend to demur from answering that, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think he's better.
Do people approach you about the film a lot over these past 25 years?
Yeah, and interestingly, they most who approach me have some sort of history with AA, mm-hmm. because I guess it's used quite a bit as a tool, both in AA and in rehab places. I'm guessing less so as the years go on, but I am approached quite a bit, and the assumption is that somehow I'm in the program, and I'm not, frankly. I never have been. So it's always a little, you know, it's always a little awkward. But I'm touched that people find something to, you know, to talk about with regard to the film. That means a lot to me.
Well, the film has always meant a great deal to me. The reasons why I connected so strongly to your movie really didn't have much to do with addiction. It was just this journey. This personal journey of this man assessing his life and what he's responsible for and trying to make amends for it, that really, really touched me. And I was 14 when I first saw it, when the day it opened. Yeah. And it's been
I was 14 when I made it. That's quite something.
That is amazing. It's just meant so much to me in my life, this movie, and I really
I think it's about. I think you hit the nail on the head. It ultimately, on some level, is about redemption. That's really, I mean, more than specifically about drugs or alcohol, it's about this idea that you can't dig a hole so deep that you can't climb out of it as long as you understand you're going to do it one step at a time. It's going to take time and, you know. To me, that's what the movie was always about. And I'm not a proselytizer particularly, and you know, I have no idea if AA is effective or not effective. I mean, I know it's effective, obviously, for a great many people, and I know there is a certain subset of people for whom it's not effective at all, and it was never meant to sort of aggrandize that. It really has very little AA in it, and almost no... The one thing I got criticized for, which was very purposeful on my part, was there's almost no mention of spirituality, which is a big part of AA, of course, the surrendering to a higher power.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, I don't want to put anything in the movie that's going to put up a firewall for people to participate in the movie, and
right.
Faith and spirituality tends to be one of those things that can be very polarizing. And I think the movie works without it, quite frankly. So
I think so too, and magically, I mean, I think what's also very impressive about it is that it completely avoids preachiness. And a lot of times with films of this type, that's what we're faced with. I mean,
we're
feeling like we're being taught a life lesson, and it's so obvious that we resent it.
No, I agree, and that, again, that was very purposeful.
Yeah.
I didn't want to do a polemic particularly.
Yeah. Well, I thank you so much for the movie and for giving me time to discuss it, and thank you so much. This has been a great pleasure for me.
No, cool. Listen, it's very flattering that you that you care. I mean, it's been quite a while since the movie came out, so it's you know, as I say, you know, it's very touching when somebody reaches out and says, "Hey, that movie meant something to me."
Very much so. That movie has stayed with me, and all of our loyal listeners definitely know about it because I don't shut up about it. It's always on my list of you have to see this movie. So yeah.
Oh, well, that's very cool.
When you just give love and never get low, you'd better let love depart. I know it's so, and yet I know I can't get you out of my heart. You I fell for you. Love brings such misery and pain. I guess I'll never be the same. I fell for you. Well, it's too bad, and it's too sad, but I'm in love with you. You love me, then you love me, but what can I do? I'm still in love with you. Well, I guess I'll never see the light. I get the blues most every night. I fell for you. Since I fell for you.